All right, good afternoon, everybody. We're ready to start. My name's Tom Friel. I'm with Cooley. I'll be the moderator for this afternoon. It's my privilege to announce the lunch speaker, and he's going to address the issue of why humans still have some good years ahead. At the age I'm at, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, he's going to talk about that topic, though, in the context of robots and artificial intelligence. Our speaker, I want everybody to know he's an inventor. He has 8 patents to his name. He's also an artist. He's a professor at UC Berkeley in robotics, automation, and new media, whatever that is. I think he'll probably explain that or might touch on that. He's a prolific author with over 200 peer-reviewed papers to his name, a frequent lecturer, and I'm glad that he's here to talk to us today. I also should mention that he has, besides patents, he has familiarity with legal issues, as he's been an expert witness in a number of patent cases, and I'll put in a plug for him. He's available. If anybody wants to hire him or talk to him about a case that they have. Now, his background, he's a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania with a dual degree in electrical engineering and economics. And he has a PhD from Carnegie Mellon. The talk he's going to give is sure to be provocative. Let's give a warm welcome to Professor Ken Goldberg.
Thank you, Thomas. And thank you, Jim, for inviting me and to all of you. I am delighted to see Berkeley and Stanford working together so effectively. What I want to do in really fast, in 30 minutes, is go over some ideas we've been thinking about in the context of robotics, and we've been hearing quite a bit about this lately. This is my lab, just briefly. These are some of my students and postdocs. All of the really innovative work is thanks to them. So let me just get that out of the way. Now, we've been hearing a huge amount in the last few years about AI and the impending challenges or impending massive changes this is going to have. Everyone saw that we've now conquered the game of Go, and AlphaGo has defeated Lee Sedol in Korea this year. And there's a lot of concerns. How is this going to affect the economy? In particular, many people are concerned about their jobs. And let me get this out of the way as well. All of you in the room are safe. Nothing's going to happen to you in this from robots. You have no threat from robots. And in particular, I'm very concerned about this term, singularity, which is very popular here in the Valley. And I may get shot by some singularitarians around here, but I'm a big critic of the singularity. I think it's a false concept. I think it's something that's creating a lot of distraction and fear. And for those who don't know about it, it's the idea that we're approaching an inflection point where suddenly technology is going to advance so fast that it will take over humans and basically leave us behind. So I'm a skeptimist. I'm very skeptical of a lot of the claims that are being published today, both in popular press, but also in by academics. And at the same time, I'm an optimist. I believe that there's a lot of enormous possibility around these new technologies. So what I want to do is talk about, first of all, what isn't new, then some things that are new, and then how we as a human race, can prepare for the future. So first, the idea of robots goes back a long way. It really is part of Western culture, at least rooted in the story of Pygmalion, going up through the Golem and Frankenstein. There's many, many examples of this. Now, so I just want to say that robots have a long, long history, and this particular fear of robots has a very long history. But now let's agree, I think we can all agree, that we are living today in an age of unprecedented change. There's nothing quite like it before. Science and technology has accelerated to the point where our lives are changing faster than ever before in history. Right? Okay, well, let's compare, for example, the first 2 decades of the last century, between 1900 and 1920, to what we're having right now, this incredible period between 2000 and 2020. Well, all they did back there was create the automobile, the assembly line, air flight, theory of relativity, air conditioning, and what we have is Twitter. Okay, so I just want to put it into context that we like to think that we're in this extraordinarily, you know, rapidly advancing period, and we are to some degree, but it's just in history, if you look back 100 years, we've been through these kind of advances before. And it has had a huge amount of changes. There's been disruptions in jobs. So many people have been put out of work. We don't see a lot of bowling alley setter-upper guys, and you know, the patch people on the phones are not, you know, we don't see them either. But many of these people have gotten other jobs, and as many new jobs have been created. So I want to say that there's hope. That the idea of technological change has been with us for thousands of years, and we're living in another period, but it's not as though it's unprecedented. Now, some of the things I think are new is that we are entering an era where the technological speeds are reaching unprecedented levels, especially in terms of Wi-Fi and connectivity. So you've heard about the gigabit society, this idea that as we move into 5G, that we're going to have accelerated ability to have access to very, very fast computation and networking that is truly unprecedented. And I'm excited about, my own area is in the field of robotics, and what are the changes that are going to come around there. Now, I want to take you back briefly to 20 years, to 93, when the origins of the World Wide Web were it was coming out. It was a very exciting period. I was teaching, I had a lab at the University of Southern California. It's a small robotics lab, and my students came to me one day and they showed me this thing. We got super excited and we thought, how do we get involved? How can we contribute to this incredible new technology? So we had a robot. We started thinking, well, maybe we can connect our robot to the internet. And so we built this thing. We called the Telegarden, and it was an industrial robot arm with a real garden in the center with a planter. And we connected it onto the internet. So this is Mosaic, for those of you who remember, one of the first browsers. And so anyone in the world could log in, and then they could visit the garden by moving around, by clicking on the screen. And if they wanted to, they could also participate by helping us water the garden, by clicking the water button there on the lower left. So this was actually the first robot on the web. And it was used by thousands of people. In fact, when we opened it up in the summer of 94, started getting more and more uses, and people would come in. We had it online 24 hours a day because it was accessible from anywhere in the globe. People were watering, and then you could also plant your own seeds, and you'd have to return back to come back to see how your seed is progressing over time. But what we didn't anticipate was, and for those of you who are gardeners will know, if you have tens of thousands of people sharing about a 3-meter by 3-meter space, it quickly becomes horribly overgrown. So what this really became was more of a story of the tragedy of the commons than what we had originally anticipated. Anyway, this was really a proof of concept. And there have been many, many robots now that are connected over the internet. And let's go fast forward to 2016. Where we are in a time when the big news is self-driving cars. And everybody's been following that news. There's a headline almost every day on developments here. It's very exciting. In fact, Google has really made a number of major investments, as many of you know, in this field. And a question is, why is Google, which is a search company, a cloud computing company, why are they getting involved in robots? And I want to point out a similarity between these two projects. That our Telegarden and the Google's car both rely on the internet for their functioning. They both use the internet many, many times. So the self-driving car is constantly getting information down off the net in terms of traffic conditions, weather conditions. As it's approaching an intersection, it's downloading the policy that have been pre-computed for that intersection. So this gives Google a huge advantage over other technology companies or car companies because they really understand the network. And how to use the cloud. So there's been this idea in robotics that's really just an assumption that we've always had, which is that robots, like humans, have to carry all of their computing and memory on board. We have to be self-contained. That's just been an assumption that's rarely been questioned until now. Because what we're starting to realize is that we now, almost anywhere you want a robot, you have access to the internet. And so this is the very exciting new frontier of what we call cloud robotics. And this term was coined by a colleague who was at Google, now at Toyota. And it's the idea that not only in cars, but in many different applications, from surgery to home robots to industry, that we can, that robots will be increasingly connected to the cloud, and that a lot of information could be offloaded into data centers that maybe are very remote. So here's an example. If we want to take, let's say we want to take the next step beyond the Roomba. And the Roomba is the most successful robot in history. It's sold tens of millions of units. But it's okay. It keeps the floors relatively clean, but it doesn't take the next step, which is decluttering. That is to be able to actually pick things up and put them away. And any of you who have kids know that this would be quite desirable. But the problem is, if you put the robot out there, it's going to have a challenge because it's constantly encountering things that it may not have seen before. So if it comes along here and it sees this, it may not know what that is and not know what to do with it and throw it into the garbage, which, as you know, if you have a kid, that could be disastrous. And there's always going to be things like this. There's going to be border corner cases where we're not going to, the robot is not going to, is going to see something it doesn't have in its model, in its internal system. So what do? The advantage is that today, almost any object that you'll find in your home, somewhere out there, there's a web page that describes it. And so there's data. There's information about the shape, the 3D model, the CAD model, the center of mass, the frictional properties, and also the semantic information about what that thing is and where it belongs in your home. So this is a first big advantage, that we can get access on demand to images, maps, models, and other forms of data that are not necessarily stored on the robot. For the second thing, let's consider the challenge. The other challenge we'd all like to have is a robot to clean up after a dinner party. So this is typical and it's easy for us. But let me just show you what it's like for a robot. That's what the robot sees. So robots today have an incredible problem with perception. Everything looks noisy and unstable to them. They have also very much difficulty controlling their own end effectors. So it's very hard to get a robot's arm to a precise point in the three-dimensional space. And they're combining those two things, the control, closing the control loop, especially in the presence of noise like this, is extremely difficult. So the central issue in robotics is uncertainty. And it arises from many, many different sources, and it's not something we can dispense with. It is an ongoing and persistent problem. The kind of uncertainty that exists, actually, statistics has been dealing with uncertainty for hundreds of years. And the problem is that the distributions we encounter here are non-parametric multimodal distributions that look like this. They're not nice, clean distributions. So there are techniques that can cope with that kind of those kind of models, which are often known as numerical methods or point clouds. But these require basically Monte Carlo integration. You're basically trying to sample these spaces with high number of points. The challenge is that as you scale up to higher dimensions, this becomes increasingly intractable. The good news is that we can use remote computing. So for doing this kind of analysis and learning and estimation, we can go to remote processing centers, data centers, and do the crunching on clusters of computers that are available on demand. So there's a number of advantages to this idea of cloud robotics, that it offers big data, cloud computing, and also can be used to facilitate open source, which is being another revolution in our field where people are exchanging code and data and at unprecedented levels. And also, it's really facilitating this another idea, which is that robots can suddenly start sharing data among each other and learning. So that when one robot learns some new skill or facility, that can instantly be shared with all the other robots in the cloud. Now, one thing I want to point out is that robot learning is going to require vast data sets. This is, if you know about what's going on with Google and Tesla right now, Google has amassed something like 2 million miles of road data with its cars that are out right in this neighborhood, driving around. And over a period of several years, they've amassed 2 million or more miles of data. In contrast, Tesla is collecting 1 million miles of data a day. It's because they have a different model. They're instrumenting all their consumer vehicles with sensors and then streaming that information up. So then they're able to get data sets, vast data sets, from all the vehicles that are out on the road. And this has enormous potential. I mean, this is a problem many of us can relate to. I encountered some of this on the way down here today. This is a huge problem. This is a case where we can solve this actually very soon. That we can, this part of it, heavy traffic, we can automate. And you can then take a nap, catch up on Facebook, all those things you want to do while you're in this heavy traffic. That's coming. We're going to see that very, very soon. In fact, a couple of my students also started a company to do this, which is trucking. It's been very successful. They sold it in 6 months for $680 million. And it's the open road, because the open road is also somewhat doable. But it's the thing in between, the suburban environment, the urban environments. Those are very, very difficult. And I'm willing to bet anyone in this room or anywhere else that we're not going to see that for at least 10 or even 20 years. The fully autonomous car that will, let's say, pick up your kids from soccer practice and bring them over, you know, to their play date. That we're not going to see. It's extremely, extremely difficult as you get into that long tail of unpredictable occurrences. Okay, now one technique that you've heard about also that is very exciting to us in the field is deep learning. And this is also taking advantage of advances in computing, but also it's a new methodology that's allowing us to build neural networks, network models that are very, very deep. We sometimes call them, I prefer to call them hyperparametric function approximators. So I don't want to get caught up in whether they're neural or human-like in any way. I don't want to over-dramatize them, but they're very, very effective at being able to express very complex functions. Now, I'll say a few words about my own work in this field, and we do work in grasping and other areas, but I want to focus in this time on some advances in robot-assisted surgery. So you may be aware of the Intuitive. It's just, again, very close by. This is the world leader company in computer-assisted surgery. They've made a huge number of advances. We've done work with a number of groups at UCSF on radiation delivery. So applying robotics to be able to deliver seeds, for example, for prostate and other forms of cancer, very accurately deliver seeds because it's very difficult to get these to proper place, and a small error in the seed placement can lead to damaging healthy tissue and also failing to damage the cancerous tissue, leading to recurrence. Now, the thing that we've been focusing on in the lab is this idea of surgeon assist. So again, we're not going to replace surgeons. I don't see that happening in my lifetime. But we do see, like, just as we're able to assist drivers in certain environments, we think we can assist surgeons. And so we've been looking at certain problems, again, subtasks that are very tedious and cause fatigue for surgeons in the OR. So something like suturing. Sometimes in the very long operations, it can be 6 to 14 hours. There's a huge amount of these kind of routine operations. It's actually quite time-consuming and requires a lot of focus, but it's repetitive. So can we automate those kind of subtasks? We've been looking into it, and it turns out to be incredibly difficult. One of the things that has helped us along this is some inventions. So since you're patent experts, I wanted to mention these. One of them we call SNAP, which is what we've done is add just a piece of plastic, but it's designed to fit onto the existing end effector of the Da Vinci, that basically allows the gripper, as it closes, to lock the needle, curved surgical needle, into a particular position and orientation. Because if you don't have that, it tends to slip and rotate. Now, human surgeons are pretty good at compensating for this, but it turns out that it's very hard for a robot when that slippage occurs. So this system, this very simple, and I call it a system, it's just a piece of plastic, really. But it's a specifically designed piece of plastic that can cause that part to snap into a nice unique orientation. So we use that. Another idea we've been using is trying to analyze to optimize the approach angle of the gripper and the needle, so that we can again minimize the reaction forces on the jaws to minimize slippage. Another aspect is the sense of touch. And one challenge with the current robotic surgical systems is that they don't offer haptics. There's no tactile feedback. And surgeons really rely on this traditionally. So they're frustrated because they don't have that. So we've been looking into ways to provide it. And our invention here is something we call the palpation probe. And what we've done is we've made use of 3D printing technology and commodity hardware to make a probe that is single use, essentially disposable. Because the challenge is that being able to do this to survive the autoclave for sterilization is very difficult. So our solution, our approach, is to just not try and sterilize, but to essentially throw it out after a single use. But this has a Hall effect sensor, and the idea is that it can respond to haptic input and then reflect that back to the surgeon on the other end. So we've been able to show, for example, that you can use this to detect inclusions, say tumors, deep beneath the surface by just sliding this across the tumor. And this is exactly what doctors do, for example, when they do palpation to detect a tumor, say, in a breast. We've also been looking into something we call the idea of being able to reuse surgical instruments. So we have an invention that we call SWAP, which is, by the way, this is what we call hackronyms. They were just sort of not very natural. But the idea is we want to be able to hot swap different tools onto the surgical end effector. So my students have designed this mechanical leverage system, and there's details in a paper where you can actually use the existing gripper to just place it inside and open it up, and it locks into place very firmly. So then you can apply scalpel and other tools from that directly from it. And another one is something we call a flip. This is based on a surgeon who approached us who was interested in applying stem cells. And it turns out that for stem cells, the challenge is that you have to place them regularly across the tissue. Because if you don't do that, they'll just circulation will wash them away and they'll disappear. You have to embed them in tissue, so it means basically injecting them many, many times at precise locations. So we've developed an end effector that fits onto the Da Vinci and is able to then inject fluids. Could be stem cells, but it could also be other forms of medicines or adhesives or any other fluids that are needed in the surgery. But it can do this very precisely. Again, this is something that humans would have a difficult time laying down a regular array or grid of injections. So this is all part of a broader research program. So we've been funded by the National Science Foundation and a number of companies on trying to study different aspects of surgery. And again, not to replace the surgeon, but to facilitate and relieve the surgeon of some of the tedium. I want to also mention that I'm heading a large institute that has now 70 faculty from 4 UC campuses. We call it the People and Robots Initiative because what we're interested in, again, is not replacing humans, replacing workers, but enhancing worker performance. Particularly, we've been focusing on this idea of cloud robotics and what the cloud can do in terms of advance the field. It's very closely related to the broader concept of Internet of Things, not only robots, but all kinds of things, sensors and devices out in the environment. And this has been really picked up by industry. So in Germany, Siemens and others have been promoting this idea of what they call Industry 4.0. You may have heard about that. Again, it's using the cloud, combining it with machinery and devices. China has gotten on board in a big way. So Made in China 2020, is the idea of the cloud being integrated into systems and with machine learning is central to the vision that they have. And now I want to end with how we can prepare. So let's come back to the idea of jobs and people being afraid that they're going to be eliminated. And there's many reasons why there is no doubt that there's enormous unemployment and inequity in the world. I don't want to deny that. But there's many changes that have happened in terms of demographics, in terms of globalization, other technologies. But it's a real danger to lay this at the door of, let's say, robotics technology. I think that this really has, there's a huge amount of almost hysteria around this, and a number of things, even the New York Times has jumped on board, and there you've seen these books and reports. Oxford has said that 47% of jobs will be replaced, which is a surprisingly specific number. And I think this all sort of comes back to sort of early fears we've always had about immigration. I mean, the yellow peril was similar, that the Asians are going to come and steal our jobs. We've heard this before. And so I love this quote. Oliver Morton from The Economist said, robots are immigrants like that, but just from the future. Now let's come back to the singularity. So again, I'm critical of it. I want to replace it with something called multiplicity. That is, rather than a singular sort of a monolithic force that's going to come and take over, I believe in something different, which is many, many machines and many humans working together to solve problems. And this is not science fiction. This is actually happening every day. So every time you use Google or Uber or almost any of the successful tools out there, you're essentially combining your input, human inputs, with very vast machine inputs to solve problems. So it's a symbiotic process. And if you know about random forests in the area of statistical learning, this is shown quantitatively that if you have many different random trees, you actually perform better than a single random tree, and we can quantify it. The key, the critical factor here is diversity, that all these trees have to be sufficiently different and diverse in order for the system to have better performance. And something like this is also happening with human groups. We know this, and it's been now being measured, which is that when you have a diverse group of people, not just the smartest people in the room, but you get a diverse group, they'll actually perform better. They're better at solving problems and better at innovating. So this key in the humans and in machines is diversity, is having differences of viewpoint, intellectual diversity, as well as geographic, gender, and other forms. These are the things I want to point out that I think are not going away. This is what humans have always been good at, and I think we're going to be good at for the foreseeable future. Robots aren't even close to being able to do these things like curiosity, creativity, initiative, multidisciplinary thinking, and empathy. So that's what I want to say is that these are still the domain of humans, and we're very, very good at them, and we're not even close to being able to tackle those with AI or robotics. Now, I want to also mention that the old school of thinking in terms of learning in general has been like what you see on the left: uniformity, consistency, obedience, rigidity, and predictable behavior, right? That's how we were taught in school. But the new wave is really different. It's changing. And it's thinking about for organizations, corporations, and universities, and basically almost every group is starting to think differently about diversity, variety, resistance, innovation, doing things that are surprising. That is a new value, and that's something, again, that humans are extremely well-equipped to do. So in coming back, what isn't new is this whole idea that in the years 1900 and 1920 are huge advances, like Einstein and others. What is new is there are advances in cloud robotics and deep learning, and then to how to prepare is to basically enhance those things that are uniquely human, our skills that are going to be needed and required for the next 50 years. So I would summarize it as remember relativity, connect the bots, and multiply your multiplicity. Thank you. I know we want to stay on schedule, so should we just wrap it up, or is there time for a question? Or?
We have a few questions.
Okay, great. Maybe the next speaker is setting up, and I can just answer any questions you might have, or push back. Or any bets? I'll take any bets. Yes.
I want to thank you all, but at what point do you think the curriculum needs to change? For example, when you have robotics and you have surgeons, you have to change what you're training them to do. So that's my question.
So how does curriculum change, or how will it need to change? And that's a great point. For example, one thing is that robots can actually help with curriculum. That's one interesting thing for training. So we're looking at, for example, using techniques from statistical learning to be able to analyze human motions, to be able to point out patterns that may be erroneous in a surgeon. So that's one area. But in general, I think it's true that in schools, we do have to change that also. I mean, I think we've spent a lot of time learning certain requirements that you have to just essentially feel like they're rote, memorizing vocabulary words and things like that. Those are still important. I don't want to radically throw everything out, but I think that what we're going to see is lots more opportunity to be creative, to have people come together and groups. And that's where I think I see real change, is like team projects, teamwork. That's starting to happen now at all levels, even in K-12, in elementary school. They're doing design thinking, where they get kids together. So that's very exciting. And I think that once people get more comfortable interacting and solving problems with a group, especially when they're diverse and people are very different than you, and you have to figure out how to get along with them and how to pull out their best ideas, that is a skill set that I think we really will push us into the future. Okay, very good. Okay, thank you all, appreciate it.